Hey everybody, welcome to Biopia Movies. This week we're talking Creepshow. Now Creepshow is a, I don't even know how you put it, it's an anthology movie, I guess, made up of several shorts, of which Stephen King wrote one, so we're still continuing our Stephen King month. In fact, I believe he was a head writer on the whole project, but a lot of these were originated as comics. He even has an acting role in this, which, much to Daniel's chagrin. If you like us, keep sharing us, keep replying to our queries, keep sending us reviews, keep doing those things that keep us on the charts, because we appreciate you, and you're the ones who keep us there. In the meantime, next week we bring the hammer down with Carrie, our final episode of our Stephen King month. We appreciate you. Thank you.
Welcome to Myopia Movies. This week we are back in King Country as we kind of talk about a movie that he wrote, but is not actually based on one of his intellectual properties. So, but he luckily acts for us in this. So he is straight out of nonsense. I hope you've liked our classic so far of The Fog and Christine and next week with Carrie. But for now, we're talking Creepshow. I am your host, Nick Hoffman, and Riffer on Cineprov. And on panel we have
Charlie Rose.
Hello, this is Daniel, and I have sent away for X-ray specs from the back of a comic. I thought I could look at the ladies that way. It didn't quite work out.
And I'm Madison.
Madison Pack from the dead.
Yeah, I jumped out like the spaghetti corpse guy. I was looking for my cake for Father's Day.
Jesus Christ.
So where is it?
My cake?
Where's my cake?
First of all, Ed Harris is a snack in this.
Oh, absolutely.
And the amount, there were no plaid shirts in Hollywood for this film was being made. but I should mention just, for those of you who are used to the show, this is going to be a very different show just because it's an anthology movie. So we'll jump around a little bit. I'll make an effort to make sure we talk about at least each of the stories a bit. Unlike, say, a standard narrative, this is just going to be different. Mm-hmm. Nothing we can do here, but we thought it would be a fun one to talk about. And God bless it. It's goofy as hell. I love this movie. This is my first time. And anyone else see it? I'm sure some of you have seen it.
I had seen it, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And it's a beautiful love letter to those 1950s horror comic books.
Yeah, EC Comics.
If you've ever read any of those, I mean, this is just lifted straight from there. I mean, especially the way they did the colors or the angles and the close-ups.
Who did the animation and the art for the comic in this movie?
You know, that's a very good question. I don't know.
We should check into it. But, like, I will just throw out here, too. This makes me, not that I ever particularly cared for some of the movies I'll mention here, but, like, Kick-Ass 300, even Watchmen, where they do things in frame form. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that this had been done in 1982 whatever. Like, this movie really kind of presupposes a lot that we take for granted in comic adaptations today. It actually does it pretty well. All things considered, especially since I could be way off here, I don't think comic books were as much a part of the lexicon as they are now.
Yeah, no. You
know. Well, especially these particular comics. I mean, by the 80s, they had been pretty much forgotten.
Yeah. Yeah. This style.
Because they'd been banned way back in the 50s.
Exactly. I mean, that's the whole thing. The horror comics, the reason Comics Code existed was because of the horror comics.
Right.
Yeah. The horror comics were actually a little too dark, a little too spicy. In fact, actually, they would go a little bit too sexy on some of them.
Oh,
and the mothers and the mothers who controlled these things did not like that.
Get out of here, Tipper Gore! No one invited you to the party.
Exactly.
What was it called? What was the committee? Where they came out with the Comics Code to prevent from being shut down?
The Comics Code Authority, was it?
Well, right, but Congress was actually investigating stuff. Like, yes. This is like 1950s Satanic Panic stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like the idea of someone seeing it like a tit would just...
Oh, yeah.
I mean, could you imagine Mimi Eisenhower? Like, she would just faint. He was dealing with aliens at this point, so he was worried about other things. That was for you. That was the last podcast. But, you know, as we get through these, we'll mention them as they go. the characters are just so over the top, but it's wonderful.
Well, and, except for Stephen King's segment, that is by far the weakest segment. Well, the one with him acting.
I liked it.
Are you saying that he wasn't over the top?
I was going to say. Are you going to say it was a grounded performance?
Oh no! He was way over the top. It just didn't work when he did it.
You didn't like his fake front teeth?
I didn't like his too short pants when he was going into that university lab.
I kind of loved it. I did kind of love it too. It's so stupid. I also just, they had so many kind of interesting character actor people in this. I like the idea that no one wanted to act opposite Stephen King, so this is the one he could do. You're a redneck farmer. Whatever you're doing, which is a word I'm not going to say anymore, you're challenged character. That's on you, buddy. Mr. Writer, you.
Well, they had one other person.
The doctor.
The doctor slash.
I really appreciated that the same person that he thought he was going to sell the meteor to is the person he also thought was going to suddenly amputate his hand.
Exactly.
What was the plan here?
I don't have an answer to you. It's as though, like, you go in one door, he's a psychologist, one door, he's an arborist, and one, he's just a guy with a knife.
It just felt like a weird improv show that I didn't know was happening during this part of the movie.
You know what, though? It'd be even better if that was just Romero, as though the only other person who wanted to be on set with him was George Romero. And by the way, if we haven't mentioned this, this is a George Romero classic.
Oh, yeah.
It's very much George Romero.
He still doesn't get his due, like, for how good of a filmmaker he was.
No, he doesn't.
No, and we've done it here too. We focus a lot on Craven and Carpenter just because we think of them as the classics guy, which fine, they are. But I mean, come on, this is George Romero we're talking about. So you want to give the first segment a bit? What is it called?
It is called Father's Day. Well, first is the wraparound story.
Oh yeah, the wraparound story. Yeah,
the wraparound is this boy's life. It's an abusive dad who's just like
Tom Atkins from Halloween 3.
He is.
And Joe Hill from Stephen King's Son.
Yes.
Oh, and from Stephen King's Son? You mean future, from the sack?
And future creator of Lock and Key, yeah. Joe Hill. Yeah.
Oh, God. Okay, so he's reading comics and his son's gonna the dad figures that reading comics is gonna make his son turn into a blank. I don't know, a communist, a sissy, some 80s slur that we're not gonna say anymore. So he throws out the comic and starts beating the child, which, you know, strong opening for King material. I know, it's classic. But this family fight where the wife is, the wife has nothing to add to the conversation. She's not allowed to speak. Yeah. It's something.
She's Edie McClurg without being Edie McClurg. That's this wife.
Edie McClurg. I know we're here.
Oh, gracious.
But so somehow in the 1980s, this kid has these 1950s comic books. We see the dad throw them out. Lightning strikes, explosion, and presumably this is kind of the kid's dreams, I guess, is the...
Well, what it is we see the comic he was reading, and these are the individual stories that were in the comic. And it's all very, very, very much a predecessor to Tales from the Crypt. You know, there's the creep who introduces the stories. But again, it's only in comic book pages. There's a bit of animation, but not much. It looks gorgeous, though.
Yeah.
And, it's really just the viewer gets to go through this evil comic that the kid was reading.
You know, Reagan dad doesn't like.
Oh, yeah.
This is supposed to...
I didn't fight in Nam for you to read them comics.
You say that, which, of course, is the joke, right? He has the mustache and the kind of glint in his eye.
Was it my dad?
To me, it stinks of, like, when Danny DeVito and It's Always Sunny talks about Nam. He was actually there just a year ago.
Yeah.
But, like, it's just like, you know, it's... Like, I wasn't there setting up a sweatshop for you to turn gay reading comics. She's just like, yeah, these are not those. Like,
those are under my bed, Dad.
I was going to say.
Oh, yeah. Doesn't the kid at one point, like, criticize his dad for keeping porn in the mattress?
Yes, yeah.
How is this any different, Dad?
Oh, that kid's going to have a weird fetish when he grows up. Anyway, so the first one is called Father's Day. And, so we got Ed Harris is visiting his girlfriend, his in-laws, whatever.
His in-laws' family.
Yeah, the wealthy people. Meanwhile, we're introduced to not Diane Keaton as the drunk aunt.
Yes.
And
Not Diane Keaton.
And she was accompanied by the poacher from Jumanji.
She was, indeed. But I just want to... Her character makes some strong drinking decisions.
Oh yeah, she does.
Carrie Nye is the actress, by the way.
Who? Excuse me?
I believe it's Carrie Nye.
Okay, there you go.
Ed Harris also makes some interesting drinking decisions in this movie.
He does. And by the way, to see him with a full head of blonde hair, shocking. He looks great.
Right before this, George Romero did a movie called Knight Riders. I'm not sure if any of you have seen it.
I've not.
It's a dramatization of a Renaissance festival, except it's deliberately anachronistic. So instead of horses, everybody's jousting with motorcycles.
Oh.
And Ed Harris is the leader of this Ren Fair troop.
Motorcycle gang.
Yeah, right.
It's, I believe, free on Freevee or Tubi or one of those. But and Stephen King actually made a cameo in that movie, too. So
no kidding.
Yep.
I like the idea, like, we're making a horror movie. Let's invite that one writer people know. Like, I mean, that's got to be what it is. Like, and it's funny because Stephen King, not really an actor. Charlie and I were talking about this earlier. How he got into this movie is probably in the contract, and that's why no one wants to act opposite him. But we've seen him. He showed up in Maximum Overdrive, but to have an ATM tell him to fuck off, which is strong choice. But he directed it, so yeah. You know, that's
Of course.
And he was in Pet Sematary so far as the minister, uh-huh. Right at the funeral scene.
He's been in a couple other like adaptations of his work, but this is, I think, by far his biggest role.
Well, I was going to say, this is the one that wasn't a momentary blip. Mm-hmm. Like, everything else is like a Stan Lee type
of
cameo.
We're getting ahead because that's the second segment, but... Stephen King cannot act.
Well, he completed level 2 at UCB, of course. He thought he was really good.
Oh, he was mistaken.
God help me. Anyway, so we should just mention that this first one we have, I don't know where you thought the story was going, but you have a rich family. I thought it was going to be a snobs versus slobs kind of thing, because Ed Harris he's looks like he's wearing his dad's outfit, right? Like,
yeah.
Because he's dressed like a working guy. He's got dungarees on. I'm sure that's what he calls them.
That flannel is tucked in. It is tucked in tight.
He's a snack of this. He looks fantastic in this.
Behrman, his name is Hank. And he looks like a Hank.
He does.
You just know he sells propane and propane accessories.
You think they met because he fixed her car?
Probably.
Damn it, Bobby.
That's right.
I mean, he might as well be singing Uptown Girl.
They're like drinking.
I mean, this is filmed in Pittsburgh. I'm just saying.
It's true.
If it was Jersey, it'd be Bruce Springsteen.
If it was Jersey, those flannel shirts wouldn't have sleeves.
That's true.
We don't need sleeves in Jersey.
But like, they show up, and like you said, the dad / hunter from Jumanji is the brother, and they're drinking out of glass. Crystal scotch out of crystal, and he's very uncomfortable. You know, they even do a thing where the mom lights a cigarette with a lighter, you know, very nice lighter, mm-hmm. and he flicks the match with his finger to light it. Like, again, this is Romero. He does it right.
Yep.
But they're all just making fun of him, kind of, and he's exactly. trying not to punch them. And it's good.
And I sort of feel bad, spoiler, he dies. I sort of feel bad that he dies because he just had the bad luck to marry into a rich family full of debts.
Here's kind of what they're going for, and you can tell because one of the characters' names is Mrs. Danvers, like right. in Rebecca. Yep. That's kind of what they're going for, like an old family clashing with this new outsider, but the family holds a dark secret.
Well, and I will also say, Romero likes classically to say that his movies aren't necessarily supposed to be about something, right? Even Night of the Living Dead, which a lot of people interpret is about race relations and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. He goes, actually, I'm going to cast whoever was the best actor. It's not supposed to be about race. If this was a Carpenter movie, there's morality. You know, a Carpenter movie is almost like a Puritan play. The people who are bad are going to die. The people who are good are going to survive. That's why the virgin survives. That's why the people who don't drink survive. I'm dead in the first 10 minutes. This says fuck it all.
Yeah.
And the good guy dies.
And it's also very consistent with these...
That's how these
comic books. These old comic books. I mean, because really, it's not that it's there to tell a complete story, you know, with this huge arc. No, it's there to give you a snippet of something.
That's right.
Well, the whole thing, I'll just go over the plot of this real quick. So the matriarch of this family murdered her father, who looks identical to Bernie Sanders, by the way.
It does.
So when he comes back to life, he gets murdered.
You
but he comes
need
back
respect
to
respect your father on Father's Day.
The living are taking too much away from the dead.
I am once again asking for my cake.
Well, and that's the point.
Yes.
She murdered him before he could get his cake.
Yes,
his
apparently he got a Father's Day cake, and he was an abusive ass about it. So there's a scene of him banging on the table going, "Where's my cake, Bedelia? You bitch!" Which, that's
a strong statement for your daughter.
Yes, exactly. But no, he ends up dying, and they buried him like behind the house, but then his corpse comes back.
Ooh, dying is a strong word.
He gets murdered, yes.
With an ashtray.
Yes.
I was going to say,
the very ashtray. You
know, natural causes of
I did appreciate that he's like, and here's the ashtray that we killed him with.
Like, that's right. Like, would you care to put out the cigarette on the evidence?
Yeah.
It's also just like old New Jersey or old Pittsburgh money, with all old Philadelphia money, where they're just like, and we made it go away because you're a poor. And you're just like, it just, it's so, anyway, we should mention that this is being told through not the matriarch. It's kind of like an open secret of the right. family that this woman killed it. Great Aunt Bedelia is Amelia Bedelia.
Yes.
Amelia Bedelia, oh, she doesn't understand how to dust the drapes. But she's doing some serious Sunday drinking and driving.
Oh, yeah.
And she is driving this Rolls to the cemetery. And
so
is like,
it's recreating the opening of Night of the Living Dead. Well done, Romero.
It is, very much so. And it's just like, you son of a bitch, happy Father's Day. And she brings a bottle of Jim Beam.
Like you do.
And plops down on the grass next to his gravestone, next to his headstone, yeah.
Strong decisions are being made this evening. But I also like how everyone's used to this. They're like, she'll join us when she's done doing her thing. And they just assume, because she just yells obscenities at this corpse, and everyone's just fine. Every Father's Day.
Does the Jim Beam bring the corpse back to life?
That's the whole point.
I actually just think this woman needed some therapy, and instead she's crying out for help, and no one in her family is helping
but
her.
But it's the 80s. No one got therapy.
No, of course. Wait,
no, wait, stop. You just gave me the right idea here, which is that there's a liquor store like Christine, and all the liquor is cursed. Because her Jim Beam is cursed, Leslie Nielsen's vodka is cursed.
Oh, yeah.
The lady in the crate.
Jordy's bottle.
His beer is cursed.
Yeah. Like, and everyone in here is drinking like, oh my God, like fish. Adrian Barbeau is just like, my husband can't get an erection. You look hot. Like, it's just, holy shit. It's just amazing.
Yeah. So there's a zombie who, by the way, is John Amplass. If you're a Romero fan, he's the guy who was Martin in Martin, which is a great movie that far too few people have seen. It's him as a serial killer who thinks he's a vampire. And then he was in Day of the Dead as one of Dr. Frankenstein's assistants, the dude with the mustache and glasses that they that gets shot in the head by Rhodes. You remember who I'm talking about there, Charlie?
Day of the Dead's been a while for me.
Okay.
It's been a minute.
He's a Romero vet that Tom Savini just put under heavy makeup.
Mm. I mean, pretty much the rest of this, very nice and tightly, is Aunt Bedelia does tend to drink a lot, but it's been a while, and no one wants to go look for her.
So I made a note about how it was so infuriating that, first off, Ed Harris's wife refuses to walk anywhere. She just keeps screaming, "Where are certain people?"
But she loves to dance.
But no one will just get up and walk. Like, are they just so rich they don't have to go places? They're just like, I shout and people come. That's just what happens.
Basically. I'll explain it to a poor, like...
Please, help me.
No, it is very much like, walking, that's what those people do. It's like, that's what the help is for. And she's playing mediocre, like this is like free, unlicensed music. It's like, dancing is fun! And Ed Harris is like, all right, fine.
Ed Harris is getting his groove thing on.
He's a snack in this. I don't know what to tell you. Meanwhile, the help is preparing like this massive meal for whatever. And the mom's like, you might as well put the pig in the oven because she'll be done soon. Which, okay. All right, whatever. Yeah. Around here is when the head just comes out of the grave.
Yep.
And just for a second, we got to talk about these effects.
Great makeup. It's Tom Savini firing on all cylinders.
It looks good. He has to make, and unlike, say, a standard Savini movie, he has to make a dozen monsters instead of just one. Yep. All of them look distinct. All of them look good. There's a lot of walking corpses and a whole bunch of astroturf.
Romero sticks to what he knows.
This thing just gets shoved out of a putting green, and it just kind of moves slightly out of the way.
That's my cake.
And that's just it. He wants a large butt. And so he's looking for cake the entire time.
I was thinking that while watching the movie.
I mean, we've all been there at 3 a.m. stumbling around.
Where's my cake?
At the end, though, he gets a little head.
Yeah.
Put on tiss. Ah, yes.
I'll be here all night, people.
Yes, he rips Sylvia's head off.
He does.
Puts it on a platter, covers it with icing, and serves it to her children.
And we should just mention along the way, a lot of other people die. It's kind of
Well, he's like, he kills Mrs. Danvers. It's like that poor, like, you know, abused help, you know.
Why was Ed Harris just waiting there to get his head crushed by that granite monument?
I mean, that's the thing. So Ed Harris is like, well, I guess there's a little Jim left. And he's sitting on the grave. And then he goes, oh, no. And the thing shakes. Oh, no. And it shakes. It's like the Monty Python bit where they keep running over and over again.
Yeah.
And then it eventually just crushes him.
And again, he doesn't do anything.
There's no morals here. Like, it's not a morality play. So everyone can just die. And he just dies. He's like the second one to die in this.
He's supposed to be pretty, not smart.
Uh-huh.
Nailed it. Who else dies? The brother and the sister go out together. But
No. Actually,
it's the mother.
The two sisters.
Right.
Okay. They die.
Right.
Ed Harris dies.
Ed Harris dies, and Mrs. Danvers dies.
Yep.
That's it.
And then the remaining brother and sister are looking for, you know, I had to walk all the way to the bathroom myself. Where's the maid? And then he goes, Happy Father's Day. And there's a candle sticking out of her eye.
Yeah.
And scene.
Yeah. And scene here.
And that's how it ends.
And scene here is they cut to the drawn comic panel of the final shot.
Yes.
And then, which is a great effect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and that is something they do for every single one of these stories, which I love.
Yes.
Yes. And just to throw it together, as they're transitioning scenes, for example, when Aunt Bedelia is committing her felony one, there's just a bunch of panels, and she goes from panel to panel to panel to panel to cemetery.
Yeah.
And it works to remind you, A, we're watching, you know, a kid's sticky pages, but also that this is a comic, you got to suspend disbelief.
Yeah. Well, and they do stylized comic stuff as well throughout of the stories. Like, you know, biff, bam, pop, you know, every now and then.
And we see it a lot, especially in the next one.
Yeah.
Because, like, he has flashbacks. For some reason, he's in silhouette. He has a green splash across his face. Mm-hmm. When he's in the doctor's room. Well, actually, we should just go there because we're here.
Yeah, we should go there. The second one.
The second story is called The Lonesome Death of Geordie Verrill. And for my money, this is probably the worst of the stories. First, because there's no suspense. You know the guy's going to die. Second, because Stephen King, like I said, can't act. But it's this farmer discovers a meteor that with this liquid inside that grows this moss or fungus that might very well spread throughout the entire world. And he gets some on himself and he's slowly dying as this moss is growing on his body.
And this is where Mulder and Scully show up, and he goes, Mulder, this lichen is going to take over the planet. He goes, Scully, it's probably from space. You're an idiot, Mulder.
Yep.
The sexual tension is through the roof.
Credits.
That's kind of it in a nutshell.
I think that they just said, Stephen King, be ridiculous. Be over the top. And he did what was necessary. I don't think he was bad. He was perfect for the comic book themed short.
The way he was acting, though, it's like, who is this guy? Because I half expected him just to start yelling out M-O-O-N. That spells meteor.
I mean.
Well, yeah. I mean, you can see the influences.
Yes.
I think he's supposed to be the R word in 1980s.
Yeah. Stephen King was a good idiot.
Yes. I'll also just throw out here, these came from a bunch of different creep shows. I think he picked, he's like, George, I want to do one. Can I pick a short one? That's kind of funny. I agree with you. It's the weakest. I don't think it's bad. I just Mm-hmm. If I'm ranking them, this is probably near the bottom. However, I think it's totally fine. But we should just mention here, cold open. Redneck on his front porch. Oh, meteor. And we have this kind of glowing meteorite land on his yard, followed by a series of fantasy sequences. This is the one with fantasy sequences in it. And
the other one, the next one has fantasy sequences too.
Oh, I guess you're right. Yep. Something to tide you over, which is...
We'll get to that in just a second.
Actually, all of these have fantasy, because something to tide you over, and then the last one.
The crate.
The crate. Oh, I've had those days. We'll get there.
Did anyone else notice that the meteor looked like the same prop from Joe Dirt?
It does. It absolutely does.
And I really appreciated that he thought that while apparently colleges back then would pay for specimens, they wouldn't want the glowing blue goo inside. He just poured it out. He's like, oh, this doesn't need to be here.
This is useless. Well, what happened was it fell. He tried to cool it down by tossing water on it, and then it cracked open. And then I don't even think he saw the blue.
No, he did. He pours it out.
He pours it out.
Yeah.
I also just like that there's a department of meteors at the local university.
Of course there is.
And they're willing to pay $200.
Well, they offered him 50 at first, and he kept trying to ask for 200, remember?
Oh, that's right.
And then when he fantasized about coming in with it cracked, he was like, I wouldn't give you 2 cents for this.
You broke it.
Oh, my gosh.
I love the idea that a meteor flying a million miles an hour hits the Earth, and it lands, and he's like, but they wouldn't accept it if it was cracked. This isn't Costco. Anyway, so, I mean, as far as this segment goes, like Daniel mentioned, there's not actually terribly a lot to it.
I do believe that it is the beginning of what is now known as cottagecore.
I can see that.
And I also think that this is a really great advertisement that's probably shown on, I don't know, whatever the equivalent of Fox News was at the time, for grow your own ghillie suit for the prepper and shut-in that you know.
He's listening to Bill Cooper. He's just like, you know what? The government is trying to take my greenstone.
AM radio is always good.
Oh, you know this guy was a fan of Art Bell.
Oh, he was. West of the Rockies, hello. Or east of the Rockies. This is still Maine, I think.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's Stephen King. Of course it's Maine.
Well, yeah. 5 miles outside of Castle Hill. Castle Rock.
It is. They have a Castle Rock sign right here. Yep. I believe if he leaves New England, he gets shot on sight. So, but like, just to give Sudsy a little credit here, he crosses his eyes the whole time. They have him in a wig to make him look like an SNL character that's playing a child. Like, and he's wearing these overalls. And again, he may be wearing exactly Ed Harris's plaid, but it's not on a body that has any form to it. So when the meteor first lands, he takes a ruler and pokes it. And that's all you need to know about this character. He then crosses his eyes. So,
yeah.
We have
it. We needed to have jokes about his penis and the fact that moss was growing on it.
We do.
Oh, I missed that part.
Oh, yeah. He goes to get in the bathtub. And he pulls open his pants. He's like, not there.
Oh, yeah. I guess I missed that part.
Yeah. Well, anyway,
he usually waxes, so he was confused to see anything growing there at all.
I noticed that
topic change.
At some point during this short story, he grabs a jug of orange juice and pours a bottle of vodka into it. Uses the neck of the vodka to then stir the jug. And I actually wrote down, when did Stephen King stop doing copious amounts of cocaine? I am convinced that that wasn't acting. I think he really did that, and I think he chugged a screwdriver.
You forgot the best part, Madison. This wasn't just vodka. This was Popov.
This is about as cheap as you can get. This is plastic bottle vodka. Oh, no, you're right. This was not acting. He's like, how am I going to get out of this scene? Let me have some thinking juice. And he's like, you know what's going to happen? Like MacGyver, I need a screwdriver. So he figures it out, and he's like, but again, considering that Popov is essentially engine cleaner, he was on to something, because that vodka is nothing but nail polish.
He was drinking it because he thought that would kill the organism that was growing on
him. Do you think that's what it was? I thought he was just trying to get drunk.
One of the two.
Little column A, little column B.
Yeah.
I do like how they show the stuff grows. He's watching the fight on TV, this old black and white TV. He's holding on to, I forget if it's a Coke at first or a wine bottle, but it's just a bottle.
It's a
with
beer bottle, I think.
It's a big beer bottle. We see like little tufts of like lichen or some whatever moss growing. And then it's on his fingers, and then it's on the bottle, and then it's on the armrest of the thing. Like, again, the directing in it is still good, other than, Steven, you just keep ripping, buddy. You yep. got this. But he's just, the next step is, we have the, like Madison said, we have $200 for the meteor, 52 cents because it's broken. Now I've got to cut off your fingers.
Yeah. Which,
I didn't know amputations were done with meat cleavers, especially at a university.
Right. Yeah.
I thought there was going to be a joke with like weed killer, like he takes out like
yeah.
something. I don't know. It's just,
well, the way it ends is kind of odd because you think that that's what it was building up to. He's trying to get rid of this, and it just spreads, and eventually his methods kill him. But no, it just grows and takes over his body. So after all night, where I think he jumped in the bath and that's what accelerated the growth, he just takes a shotgun and kills himself.
Exactly. But I think that it's very much a classic, you know, comic book horror story where there's no real resolution.
Right.
It's just showing you this is the first step of the world collapse.
Okay, because they do say at the end, the forecast calls for heavy rain over the next week.
Right. And They cut to a picture where you see this mossy growth going down the road.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Right. I mean, and throughout the whole thing, despite his acting, whatever, it starts on his hand, right? And his nervous tick is to put his fingers in his mouth. So where's the next place it is? It's on his face.
And on his
tongue. Then he starts to freak out and rub his chest. But then it grows along his chest. And so, like, they're logical things that they're doing here.
Yep.
And, you know, again, he accidentally grabbed that can of Miracle-Gro and it just started spreading. But throughout the whole thing, we see, you know, the tension building. He opens the door. The whole truck is covered as though everywhere where it dripped is now growing. It's scary, you know, kind of. Well.
Kind of. I still stand by it's the weakest segment, but we're getting.
You're going to get in an argument.
Well, but it's leading into the best segment of this movie, and that's something to tide you over.
Yeah. He takes a bath, kind of. He realizes his penis no longer exists. Like you said, he shotguns himself. We get the road getting grown over, and then we smash cut to Ted Danson.
To Leslie Nielsen knocking on Ted Danson's door.
Yeah.
Ted Not Danson. A sitcom plot.
Talk about a snack. Dude. He was young and hot.
That was a hair helmet.
True. But that was like the 80s.
Also, I made note of this. Did men back then just have more hair, or were they using product like mousse? Like, how did guys back then have such luxurious hair?
I think they grew it. I mean, I think it's a little bit of both. I don't know when Ted Danson started going bald. It was probably soon after this.
Yeah. Well, he's got hair plugs now. Like, all the hair he's got in the good places.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. And if you haven't seen it, there's a great episode of Cheers where he pulls his wig off.
Oh.
Yeah.
See, it's not until the mid-80s that everyone becomes obsessed with the hairless, smooth type of, you know, hot leading man. Whereas, like, through the 70s and the early 80s, it was all like, oh, average looking guys, they're super hairy. That was like apparently everyone's jam.
Mm-hmm. Well, to answer your question, the early to mid 80s was also a throwback to the 50s. And so you do have a lot of not gelled hair, but like pomade, like, you know, like the leave-in conditioner. That's why it's shiny and full. And this is even kind of pre-mullet because he does have hair in the back, but it's not like, it's not a Kentucky waterfall.
Yeah.
It's, you know, he looks, and I mean, hell, Leslie Nielsen has that beautiful white hair still too. Like, it's a battle of hair.
Well, it was the Jesus cut that was so popular amongst everyone.
Amongst the rich yuppies of the time.
That's right.
Which these characters both are. I mean, to go over what happens here, Leslie Nielsen is a cuckolded husband who decides to kill his wife and her lover. That's Ted Danson is her lover, and Galen Ross from Dawn of the Dead is the wife.
Yes.
So, another nice Romero vet coming back. But he kills them by burying them up to their heads on his private beach and then just letting the tide roll in and having them drown.
Yeah.
But he records it.
Yes.
Because he's a total freak.
He's a shutterbug.
Now, I will also point out that there are several of these where the technology is sort of prescient in a way. Yeah. When you think about it, you know, the way that he was doing his technology and had all these video recordings and surveillance. I mean, it's like the same type of story that could be told today. It's not dated.
I think that was kind of becoming more common in the 80s, where it's like access to modern technology meant you were the villain. Like David Lynch did that a bunch in his career.
I mean, it was still cutting edge because, I mean, 1982 and VCRs and home recordings like that were still a little bit, you know, upper richy.
Well, in terms of his status as a rich man, and I'm surprised Nick hasn't brought this up yet, he's got a lionfish in his aquarium.
He does.
Just like in Naked Gun.
I mean, I will say, of the ones that, I mean, you could remake all of these in a modern context.
Yeah.
Do like a Twilight Zone, the movie thing without the death.
Yeah.
But this one feels like it really could have just
been. It really could. You know, yeah. Absolutely nothing changes.
You film it with Ring cameras instead, yeah, and it's exactly the exact same. Like, it is. Yeah. But we have Leslie Nielsen in a series of wool sweaters.
Yes.
We have Ted Danson and, you know, Breeze in his hair. Like, we end a series of robes. There's some wonderful robes in this.
It's fairly straightforward, though. Both the wife and the lover die, but they disappear by the morning. So Leslie Nielsen thinks that their bodies were drug out to sea. But no, they come back as zombies to bury Leslie Nielsen up to his head.
Well, and we should just mention the little things here. Leslie Nielsen is a hell of an actor. And it's funny because I'm most used to his second act being the awkward straight man, especially in the last 10 years before he died. Some really terrible comedies. I tried to watch Wrongfully Accused and I turned that right off.
I remember that one. Watched a lot when I was a kid.
I did too.
Doesn't hold up?
Not really. Spy Hard is fine, but you know, the Naked Gun movies are a lot of fun, and Airplane is a lot of fun, and yada yada yada. He's very funny, so to see him playing a shitheel here,
yep, and he does a great job.
Yeah.
Well, I will say this. I haven't seen this. I don't know, probably late 80s, early 90s. So back when I was in college, high school actually, and I remember distinctly that last line. He says, "I can hold my breath for a long time." Yeah. And he starts laughing. I remember that. And for some reason, I found that extremely creepy when I was a kid.
It is something. Because it's the one where a lot of these, I guess we don't really see the comeuppance, so to speak.
Yeah.
But we don't see him die. And so maybe also, he does come back.
His victims came back. So why wouldn't he?
Yeah. I do like that in this show, you know, this whatever, this anthology, spite is the most powerful motivator.
yes.
Oh, I dig it.
The creepiest part for me in this, and that was actually when Leslie Nielsen was watching the video feed as Ted Danson's yelling at him.
Yeah.
And then a wave hits his face, and he's like, "Ooh, you got to take a breath there. Got to make sure you're taking a breath."
Yeah. Bad form.
Yeah. He's narrating, and it's just like, oh.
My favorite bit of this. Essentially, it's a dig your own grave scenario, right? Mm-hmm. Kind of. He buries him in, right?
Right.
Up to his neck. And Leslie Nielsen is like literally smacking him on the cheek. Like, and there's hair in his ears and in his eyebrows. Like, they're sand. They're really messing with him. Leslie Nielsen goes off to get his car, to get the TV and the camera to all set up. And there's just a crab.
Oh, the blue crab?
Yeah.
It's like a cameo appearance.
It's like hanging out. He's like, "Get this crab away." Like, not like, "Dig me up, but like, get this crab away." Apparently that's the crisis point.
Crabs are freaky, man.
Well, and
ask Amelia Earhart. Yes. No, we can't.
Oh yeah, we can.
Also, just due to the forced perspective of the camera too, it looks like he's driving about 3 inches from his head.
Yeah.
It's just a lot. He turns the TV on to watch the woman drown. And he goes, "Where is she?" "Oh, she's on the other side. She couldn't even hear you scream." Yeah. "I own the whole thing." They'll never hear you. It's so good.
I also thought it was interesting that, first off, these are two notes about Ted Danson's character. The first being that when he first opens the door, he makes some kind of vague threat that he bench presses 300 pounds, which I immediately, you could look at my notes, I said there's no way he benches 300 pounds. Later in the, as it continues, I wrote, if he could bench 300 pounds, I bet he'd be making some progress getting out of the sand. Called right? It. So yes. That's one. Two, did he really try to bribe gazillionaire with money?
Yes, he did.
Like, yeah. This is like going to Bezos and being like, please, I'll give you $20. Please just get me out of here. And he's like, okay, what? No?
If they're not getting bathroom breaks, you're not getting out of here. But yeah, no, it's really something. And then, like you said, he pours himself an entire beer glass of vodka, and he's watching six TV screens because he's a rich guy, so he has six TVs.
This is Saw's origin.
Like, yes, it is.
By the way, I know he's dead. R.I.P. Tobin Bell's fine. Leslie Nielsen as Jigsaw would have been a thing. Would have really.
He would have made really bad jokes and puns the whole time.
And Jigsaw doesn't.
There would have been a rubber chicken somewhere. A fart machine. Oh, absolutely. Yes.
I mean, they're about to come out with Saw 10.
If somebody said to him, like, surely you can't be serious.
Oh.
That'd be it.
I am serious. And don't call me Shirley.
I also appreciated his Juicy Couture tracksuit. Because, he does. You know,
oh, my gosh.
You know, every good trend is hot if old men and teenage girls wear it.
Could you imagine? I mean, for a second, he joins the New Jersey Mafia in that last scene. He's just wearing a velour tractor. And then we see the sexiest thing of all.
The shower scene. Thank God there was a shower scene with him. That's what I needed in this movie.
I didn't realize how tall he is. He's huge.
That's what she said.
Girl.
Hey.
Madison, where's your other hand?
There we go.
And
Matt has joined the podcast.
Good times.
It turns out that, like you said, bodies disappear. He assumes they just go out with the tide.
Mm-hmm.
But as he's, I mean, it's a scene right out of, you know, a Wes Craven movie. He's like, I'm going to go get naked and take a shower. It turns out that the monster shows up.
And they're like covered in seaweed,
and again, great makeup job. They're mm-hmm. they're all gray. They're dangling.
They look the like eyes. Oh. They look like ocean zombies.
Yeah,
and then they have these like pustules that ooze like seawater.
Well, he shoots them, and then instead of blood, it's seawater that comes out.
No notes. That's fantastic.
Their bodies even looked bloated, as if they had been in the water. Like you
their
said,
lips,
like, yeah, like
especially.
I mean, you said it. Savini was. Yes. All about being Savini, and he did a fantastic job.
Yes, he did.
I'm also really glad he made a cameo at the end of the movie, too.
Right?
That was really fun.
Taking out the trash.
Hey, look at this!
So after this is The Crate.
The Crate.
Which I believe actually was like a Stephen King short story that he submitted before he got big to Playboy or something.
Oh, really? So this is not...
I think so. That or Hustler. It was something.
Playboy, Hustler, Penthouse, one of those used to publish King's short stories, and I'm pretty sure that this is one of them.
This short story, to me, is a PSA about knowing your limits in all parts of your life, but especially drinking at your husband's work parties.
Dude, no, it's really like...
She has no limits because she stays drunk the entire...
She's Billy.
Yeah. Drunk the entire time.
Dude, it's something.
If she stops drinking, the collective hangover will kill her.
Yes.
Well, I mean, and like, it's just...
You know your aunt at Thanksgiving?
That's her, but worse.
Yeah.
We haven't really talked about this, but this is a good place as any. The transitions between these things are really something sometimes. And this is where it's the strongest. Because Nielsen is losing his goddamn mind. He's sweating. Yeah. He's screaming. He's banging on the door. And then we smash cut to a garden party.
Yep.
You know, he's really acting. And then we cut to a janitor who finds a crate under the stairs. It's just, it's really, it's good. And we do get a title. And on the klaxon it says, you know, The Crate. It is what it is. So underneath the stairs is a crate that says 1838 or something.
It was from an Arctic expedition.
In
1834.
Yeah. Yep.
And this is Miskatonic University. This is...
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, clearly.
This is Lovecraft nonsense, which is... It's fine. It's good for a short story here, but that's exactly what it is.
But wouldn't it have been fun if The Crate had been full of National Geographics and Reader's Digest?
Yeah. I'm just wondering how...
just pornography. It's just piles and piles of pornography.
Oh, that's where I put this boss. My bad.
I'm just wondering how that baboon thing lived down there for a century and a half with no food or water.
You're asking questions.
I am.
You shouldn't be.
This shouldn't.
No.
You're thinking. You know what? Stop thinking.
Yep.
Okay.
You're watching a movie called Creepshow.
It's a magical Yeti. What do you want?
It is the Halloween store version of a Yeti, and it's really yeah. something.
Yeah, it's true.
We should mention here too. This is Hal Holbrook, looking like a child. I've never seen him so young. I'm used to seeing very, very old Hal Holbrook, but he's good at this. His wife is Adrienne Barbeau, who is the one who is hitting on everyone and calling him stupid
constantly.
Which is really a lot of strong choices being made. but this, yeah.
And future Catwoman Adrienne Barbeau is his wife, who is just an absolute embarrassment to him.
Yeah.
Because he's trying to make a good impression to his fellow colleagues, including George Romero's wife at the time, Christine Forrest, who is in this segment.
Is the tall dude the one who is also the tall dude from Reanimator? Or am I getting confused?
I thought the same thing, but no, it's not the same actor.
Okay. So
they look a lot alike.
They do look a lot alike. So we got Robert Harper, who is in things. I don't know. He's in Once Upon a Time in America. He's in War of the Roses. He's in Deconstructing Harry. We have the guy who plays the janitor. He's Fritz Weaver. He's in Thomas Crown Affair, the more recent one, and Marathon Man. Because these people are 1,000 years old, and they're in everything. Long story short, they're at this garden party. Adrienne Barbeau starts what turns out to be an alcoholic problem as she drinks for the entirety of the short, which goes until like 4 a.m.
This is a case where alcohol has a Billy problem.
That's right. but this janitor guy's like, hey, boss, I found this crate filled with pornography. You want to see it? And he goes, well, it doesn't sound very interesting. He goes, it's from 1838 and it's marked the Arctic. And he's like, well, I probably should check it out.
Wasn't that right after he had been like flirting with what looked like a teenager?
Oh yeah, no, he's a guy who picks up his grad assistant, which is what we hear from what's her name. Billy says it later.
Yeah.
Because the way that what's his name? Hal Holbrook kind of gets out of the thing, goes, oh, he's come across another problem with another one of the teaching assistants or whatever.
Yep. And they open the crate. There's the baboon monster inside, who was nicknamed Fluffy, by the way, during the shooting.
Oh, like on the set?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That's cute.
Nice.
So then Fluffy eats the janitor and then later eats a student.
Yeah. Oh, the Wunderkind.
Yes.
The Wunderkind, the one who's like, oh, he'll have the Nobel Prize by the age of 20. This kid is 45, but you know, whatever. Stephen King in a different role. But all that to say, this is kind of a, talking to X-Files earlier, it's a Monster of the Week episode. Like, it's an unexplained thing. They open the crate. It's just a hand that pulls the poor janitor in, and it goes, hey, Professor, help! It's eating me! Oh, God, it's eating me! It's really something.
You see a lot more of Fluffy than I remembered you seeing. I thought you'd, like, maybe get a glimpse, but you get some close-ups.
You see its face multiple times. Like, they invested money into that face, and so they used it.
I really wish more would do that. I want more monsters in my monster movies.
Yeah.
Well, and more practical effects.
Oh, yes, 100%. I always want practical effects over anything else.
Apparently, though, Fluffy was not the most expensive part of making this movie. We'll get to that later.
Was it?
What was it?
Was it all the green roaches? And Geordies?
Yes. Yes, it was.
Oh.
The roaches?
Yes. Yeah.
Dude, the end of that movie.
Did they have to pay for those roaches? I feel like I know where we could go get those.
They like, they had to buy them at like $25 a roach from some...
Are these specially trained roaches?
They're or something?
Movie star roaches? Was this for... Oh, you know what? I bet this was for like their... The, you know, this What's is for their agent.
Something like that.
Yeah.
We support you.
Anyway, Charlie, the professor, calls Hal Holbrook to try and help him. And Holbrook decides... This after a couple fantasy sequences where he imagines murdering Billy.
Dude.
Graphically.
The first one is just... He pulls out a gun and shoots her between the eyes. Just like,
and everyone in golf dirty Harry shot.
At the garden party, and everyone just turns and looks and at him. And then...
Great shot. Bullseye.
Which, by the way, if
Good show, old sport.
I think you clap for him.
Yeah, they do. No, they do. They all soft clap. Like, they do a golf clap for him.
It's a strong choice. So the professor is interested in seeing this, whatever's in the box. What's in the box? And, you know, like you said, he's supposed to go visit Hal Holbrook to play chess.
Yes, but Dexter goes there because Dexter is, like, freaking out.
Right.
And basically tells him the story. And, you know, Henry basically thinks to himself, well, this is a great way to get rid of my terrible shrew of a wife.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and she's gone to class, which I assume is just getting railed by a grad student.
I would assume so.
But she goes, just make sure he's gone by the time I get back.
I also appreciate... And by appreciating, I'm joking, how she was like, don't make a mess and don't just put the pans in there to soak. You better wash them. I better not come home to a mess. Like, lady, wait, let me get this straight. So you're hammered 24/7. You scream and belittle your husband in front of all of his colleagues and friends. And then you force him to do all of the cleaning around the house. What are you bringing to this to the table here?
He's the one working and she doesn't have a job.
Yeah. No. Well, she probably can't hold down a job. She also probably can't start her car without blowing into something. So,
when they
were
introducing her, they said, and she is Henry's wife.
And Billy's, we all ignore her. So
the strange thing, though, about his plan is it works. I mean, at first they do a fake out where she starts talking about how he can't get it up anymore.
I was going to say, it's like, you couldn't find a monster in my pants either. Like, it just, it's a lot. And then all of a sudden, like,
goes, and then Fluffy comes out.
And then he's never been harder. Like, it's just, it's so clear that he's like, oh, thank God. Also, he's really good at getting rid of evidence, it turns out.
Yes.
Because he puts on an apron and just starts mopping up the blood.
Well, because that was the other part is that apparently, when this creature eats, it eats everything.
Yeah.
Everything. So that's why it's the perfect crime, because there's no bones, there's no body, there's nothing.
So we're making a lot of assumptions. Maybe what this thing does is like what owls do, and later it's going to regurgitate up a pellet of fur and clothes and bones.
Just a work boot sticking out of a pellet.
I'm just wondering how much bottle of vodka.
Oh, Chris.
That's what it ate. There we go. It's like a beta fish.
No, what I was going to say is, you're probably right. The reason he was able to catch it at the end is after getting Billy, it got a secondhand drunk on, and so it couldn't fight back anymore. And so it's like, gotta sit down. And he's like, that's how he was able to close the lid and knock it.
Yeah. No, it's like when they drink the blood of people that have done drugs and what we do in the shadow. Yeah, right.
I'm picturing a lure scenario from Futurama after he ate the hippie. Remember that?
That's right. But that's what it is. Like, he's like, oh, God. Madeira and vodka? Jesus Christ, lady. Like, but yeah, so Hal Holbrook covers up the evidence. His wife is just eating. And he goes back. We should also mention he drugs Dexter at one point.
Yeah. He drugs Dexter so Dexter's asleep and doesn't know that he's doing all this.
Yes.
But he takes he's able to chain up the box, the crate, and then drive it to a quarry and dump it in.
That's right.
And then how does the story end? The box breaks and then Fluffy gets out.
Correct.
Yeah, we see a hand, we see a step, and then
we see the eyes.
That's right. So like the King story or something, we don't know. It's good. I will say, if the King one is the worst, this kind of was my favorite one because we have such elevated characters. Like, we do. It's over the top. I also like the Roach one a lot for different reasons, which we'll get to. All of them are good. This one, I think, is the most absurd. It's the most over the top. It's got some just... you suck and your erection. Like, it's just like when you're talking about your husband's penis right before you get killed, the audience is kind of on his side. It's good. Nice. It was a nice touch by Mr. King. It's also, I think, by far the longest one.
I have a feeling that people that maybe aren't horror movie buffs or maybe haven't even seen all of Creepshow are familiar with at least this story. I feel like this story transcends Creepshow, and I think a lot of people that maybe aren't as into this as we are even aware of the story.
And we should also just mention, like, the way that they filmed this is incredible. There's a lot of strong lighting choices. Like, Dexter is drugged upstairs. The wife comes home. Billy comes home. And Henry has left a note and said, Dexter got in trouble with one of the grad girls again. I got to go help him. And she's poured herself a glass of milk. And next to the sink is like an entire bar set. And she's just pouring either bourbon or rum into her milk.
Into her milk.
And yeah. She's reading this note aloud. And she's like, ha, him and the grad girls. And you're just like, what on earth? And she goes, I guess it's time to go driving. And then She drives to the college. It's just, all of these decisions are incredible. And just as her husband is taking off the apron, which again is something that she just wants to see. She wants to diminish him. He's like, you should look in there for the girl. She's scared. You should go help her.
And he's laughing as he's
under
saying
the stairs.
That.
Under the stairs. She just, which by the way, what is Dexter known for? Which is something.
Apparently touching people.
To the point where they're hiding under the stairs.
Where they're hiding where that's a believable story. Wow. Academia in the 80s.
That's right. Steven Seagal's house.
oh boy.
Fuck dungeon. But anyway.
It's because no one wants to have sex with Steven Seagal, so he has to tie them up.
Enemy of the state, Steven Seagal. But yeah. So we have, you know, it ends like the Thriller video where we get cat eyes and then smash cut to the next one.
Which is they're creeping up on you. The cockroach one we've mentioned, it's about this very wealthy Howard Hughes-like shut-in who's a complete germaphobe. And he's seeing cockroaches scattering around his giant penthouse that's made to look up like a hospital room. He's basically living in a giant hospital room.
Well, I mean, I think they meant to create something that was evocative of the future.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's the feeling I got too.
And white on white on white is definitely something that conveys that.
It's the William Hurt 1984 that comes out a couple of years later.
You mean John Hurt?
John Hurt.
Or 2001.
Yeah. And by the way, this guy, the actor is E.G. Marshall, who you might know as one of the dads from National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation.
He is Beverly D'Angelo's dad.
Yeah.
That's who he was.
He's also in classics in a different way, 12 Angry Men, Tora, 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 and he's the president in Superman 2. And he looks like the monster from Young Frankenstein in this.
Yeah.
He's got the aggressive skullet out to the nines. Essentially, the plot line is, like Sudsy said, is a Howard Hughes-esque hypochondriac, germaphobe, nutjob type, but he's going through a corporate hostile takeover right now, mm-hmm. and not only is his stock going through the roof for this hostile takeover, mm-hmm. it turns out that the previous head of the company he's taking over has just killed himself in shame.
Yes. This is like, you know, the bread and butter of the 80s. I mean, the only thing that's lacking is, like, you know, him saying, a la Gordon Gekko, greed is good, you know.
Yeah, and, you know, the assistant's kind of saying that, like, congratulations, sir. And by the way, he is one of two people we actually see. Everything else is done over phones to make it feel more distant and, like you said, kind of more future-y, right? This is the corporate takeover.
Well, and again, this is another one that I feel is very prescient, you know. It's very focusing on potential. It can easily be done today. Mm-hmm. And even the theme and the context of the 1% horrible multi-millionaire billionaire who is so casually disregarding other people's lives. Oh, and old white guy being racist.
Yes.
The old white guy being racist is really something. What we were missing, though, is him and his friends getting together and singing Imagine.
Well, I will say, I know they were trying to go with people of color being like an insult, but when you look through the lens of the 21st century, mm-hmm. people of color is the preferred term.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
although I'm sure E.G. Marshall's character did not enjoy being called a honky.
Oh.
That was strong choices were made. I mean, as far as like what to talk about in this, there's not a lot. It's another essentially one-man show.
Yeah.
He does a very good job at being creeped out and very uncomfortable. And, you know, like the only other person we get is, well,
the guy's widow calls him.
Yes, you get audio. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the building supervisors are on call, or the building, whoever's on call. But you really don't even see his face. You just see his mouth.
Right.
Right. So he sees a roach. We're in the South, man. I hate these fuckers. But we eventually see all kinds of roaches, which is really
all over the place, too.
All over the place. But he essentially is trying to live in this, you know, he's in lockdown on COVID. And he doesn't want to see any other buggy. He doesn't want to see. So he calls the super of the building who's in Orlando taking his kids to Disney World. So they call the maintenance man who's working that night, who's literally just called Mike the janitor, I think. Or whatever, he's a janitor. He's working on staff that night. And he's calling the one 24-hour fumigation service in the city.
Yeah. This is in New York, by the way. We see the skyline later when there's a blackout.
Yep. And then the basic thrust of this is the people are calling. We have his assistant. We have the woman who is the wife of the guy who killed himself. Who calls him a monster. Apparently they knew each other before. And he goes, my husband just had your number and he's dead because of you.
I thought he left a note that said his name on it. I thought
probably.
I think that's what
it was in the husband's address book, I think.
Oh, maybe that's it. Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, however you cut it, the idea being that she's trying to threaten him and he said, well, you know, he says something awful. I forget what the line is.
I also think he laughs at her when she talks about her husband's suicide. And then he cuts her off to complain about his bugs to her.
Yep.
Because, you know, that's what you do.
Absolutely what you do. But no, this is the one that I found actually to be truly terrifying.
Because
the fact that it just, cockroaches create such a, whether you call them, you know, water bugs, cockroaches.
Palmetto bugs.
They create that visceral, disgusted reaction.
You just have this vile feeling like no other bug. And they start to show up and there's more and more, and he finds it in his food.
Well, and like we should mention too, what makes it powerful is again the coloring, because he's in an all white room and these things have the shiny black carapace, and so it's all the more stark, because he's also wearing essentially like a robe, and he has this nervous tic where he's not only wearing latex gloves, but the second he wipes anything, like even to dial the phone, he takes out a single Kleenex, he dials it. And then there's a little incinerator thing next to him. And by the end, of course, the roaches are coming out of everything. They're on him. I don't know how they filmed this.
By the end, they're in him and burst through his
body.
Which
was so good.
Oh, yeah. So what happens is he decides to lock himself in a clean room, a panic room. And he thinks, oh, they're not going to be able to get in there. Well, then he sees the bed move, pulls back the covers, and it's just a total, like, layer of cockroaches.
It's like Moses Lack's vibrating recliner. Same mentality.
It is. It's like a weird 80s vibrating hotel bed. It's really, it's very unsettling. And like you said, the power goes out across the city. And so the second half of this, the lighting is non-existent. It's a lightning strike. It's a weird emergency light.
Which they use when he looks up and sees the cockroaches in that light fixture.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Or the lightning will strike and the sink will be full of roaches, or they'll be coming out of his little garbage chute.
This was just beautifully done with practical effects. I mean, these days they would do this digitally.
Yeah, and it wouldn't be nearly as good.
And it would, absolutely. This was my favorite of them all, only because it was very well done. Yeah. It had a lot of visceral feelings that it enacted within me. And it just left an impact. It's one of the ones that I just thought about for years and years and years.
Well, and like you mentioned, the whatever his name is, the janitor goes, like, we're calling the people, and you just see his kind of his teeth and his mouth in the look through thing. There's a word. But later on, they're knocking, no one's answering, and we're panning around now a room without roaches.
Yep.
They've all just left. The power's back on. And then the dummy starts shaking.
The body. And they just burst out from everywhere, like under the skin, through the mouth.
So well done.
Oh, so beautifully done.
And he has this jukebox, which is playing music, and it cuts to it, and then it cuts back to him, and then it cuts back. And then the room is just half filled with roaches.
Oh, yeah. No, and by half filled, you know, the walls are all glass. And it's literally like 3 feet of roaches.
It's incredible. And they're just writhing. And then we cut to a cartoon of it. And we should mention, too, throughout this whole thing, occasionally it cuts to a comic panel.
Yeah.
But, like, he there is shocked. And then there's the spinning spiral behind him, like it's vertigo. And then there's this little roach icons around him. Strong stuff. Mm-hmm. Strong stuff. That's the last one. And so we cut back to our framing narrative, which is just the kid's comic book getting picked up by some garbage men, one of which is Romero.
No, it's Tom Savini.
Oh, Savini. Yeah. Savini's the guy with the mustache, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. And they're going through and they're basically making note of all the things that you can mail in.
Right.
And it's like, oh, well, this one's already been mailed in, so we're not going to be able to get the voodoo doll. And so you go, I wonder what that's about.
And we cut back to All American Dad, who's having his coffee. He's like, you know what? My son hasn't been hit yet today. And the mom is like desperately trying to iron and ignore what's happening in her home. And then the dad starts grabbing his throat.
Yeah.
his neck. He just cut to the kid who's, stabbing the
doll repeatedly.
And the mom is like ironing a yellow shirt that has a weird thing, like
we're cut out, and that shirt is on the voodoo doll, and so you're just like, and it ends.
And that's the end of the movie.
A smash cut to the Crypt Keeper, and then credits. That's it, right? So, great movie. Let's start with our least common host, Madison. What was your final thought?
I have to say, my final thought on this movie is that I think Leslie Nielsen was approximately 60 years old for 3 decades, and I think that's really great for him.
Yeah.
That's a good solid.
This is a great, great movie. I mean, some of the stories are better than others, but overall it's just really skillfully done in that it evokes just how those comics used to look. Mm-hmm. And just because Stephen King read those when he was a kid, and that's what really inspired him. So this is like a big generational thing, and you just feel that everybody involved loved this material. Mm-hmm. And that really shines through. And George Romero was great, and he still doesn't get enough credit for the great movies he made. And if you really want to get into him, this is a good place to start.
I have to agree. Daniel pointed out, you know, this is material that clearly, both Romero and Stephen King created a love letter to these old EC horror comics. I mean, it's very clear. They capture the tone of the stories. There's, a little bit of animation here and there to really create that fun feeling. And I'm a sucker for horror anthologies.
Same.
I mean, this is good stuff. And I love this one. I love the sequel, Creepshow 2, Creepshow 3, no. And the TV series is actually pretty good too. So I will say thumbs up. You should watch it.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'll just add, it scratches that 80s itch as well. It's kind of gory, right on the edge of having digital effects, so they kind of go all out, and we have a lot of good fake blood and a lot of good makeup work and a lot of fun. There's not a lot of budget here, so they use it exactly where it needs to be used, right? You pay actors just enough, right? Because these are only segments. You don't have to pay them the whole, movie salary. And so you get a lot of good roles acted by a lot of good people like Stephen King. But yeah, so I recommend this. And so just throwing it out there, next week we're doing kind of, ironically, we're going back to the beginning, doing Carrie, which is already in the can and is a really good episode. So I hope you enjoy it. But in the meantime, thanks for doing all you do to make us stay on the movie charts. My Opie Movie is only here because you guys listen to it. And so, ladies and gentlemen out there in Radio Land, please keep recording, reviewing, and sharing, and making sure other people know you listen, because that's how more people find the show. Thanks, everyone.
Myopia Movies is a podcast production of Dude Letter Podcasting and is produced by Nick Hoffman. It is edited by Ner Trinette and Daniel Suttis and is hosted by Nick Hoffman, with production assistance by Matthew Quinn, Daniel Suttis, and Ner Trinette. The theme song is Surf Shimmy by Kevin MacLeod from incomptech.com. Licensed under the Creative Commons by Attribution 4 license, Creative Commons/licenses by /4.0. Thanks.